Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's hearings before the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Aviation and Space on the failure of oversight which allowed Boeing to certify the new 737 MAX 8, which is clearly not a safe plane, since two of them have already crashed, killing all 346 passengers and crews aboard. Jeff Wise, a licensed pilot and a science journalist specializing in aviation and psychology and author of The Taking of MH370, who has an article at Slate, When the Rules Disappear, How American Fervor for Deregulation Contributed to the 737 MAX Crashes, joins us. We'll discuss the Trump administration's war on regulations and the capture of the FAA and Elaine Chao's Department of Transportation by Boeing, who also have a 30-year executive, Patrick Shanahan, as the Secretary of Defense, allowing an unsafe airplane to be certified by Boeing and sold around the world. Since Boeing decided not to design a new plane from scratch and just added length for more passengers and bigger engines, which had to be moved further out on the wings, the plane's Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, MCAS, is essential to enable this unstable plane to take off and fly. So with a hands-off approach to big business combined with the pursuit of short-term profits while cutting corners, one of America's most successful brands, Boeing, is now losing its luster as the United States under Trump becomes more of a banana republic. Then with today's White House meeting with the wife of the alternative leader of a country that is disintegrating into chaos and lawlessness and is poised on the brink of civil war, we will go to Caracas for an update on Venezuela's rapidly deteriorating conditions. Virginia Lopez, who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English and has a recent article at The New York Times, Nothing Can Prepare You for Life with Hyperinflation, joins us to discuss how life is becoming unbearable inside the country, while outside, irrelevant arguments over capitalism versus socialism and sovereignty versus imperialism drone on. Then finally, we are joined in the studio by an activist and performance artist who stages acts of creative resistance to arouse public awareness of human rights, animal rights, the environment, and LGBT rights. Jordina Salabert, otherwise known as Jill Love, joins us to talk about some of her exploits, such as sitting on a golden toilet on top of Donald Trump's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, reading Time magazine with Trump on the cover, and covering her naked body with oil, posing in public squares like a beached dolphin surrounded by dead fish to draw attention to stop offshore oil drilling. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Jeff Wise, a science journalist specializing in aviation and psychology, a licensed pilot. He has served as an on-camera aviation analyst for CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, and his articles have appeared in the New York Magazine, the New York Times, Time, Business Week, Esquire, and many others. And he's the author of The Taking of MH370 and has an article at Slate, When the Rules Disappear, How the American Fervor for Deregulation Contributed to the 737 MAX Crashes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Wise.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And in the testimony today before the Senate, the Transportation Secretary, Elaine Chao, more or less offered the sort of boilerplate homilies about doing thorough investigations and improving oversight. But isn't this really a case of regulatory capture? I mean, the idea that Boeing could certify the plane itself, there seems to be a direct line here between self-certification, the clout that Boeing has through enormous lobbying power, and of course the acting Secretary of Defense is a former 30-year veteran executive of Boeing. So is this too incestuous a relationship that Boeing's had with particularly, well, obviously with the Trump administration, but I think prior administrations as well?
I mean, the short answer would be yes. But to go into a little bit more detail, listen, I mean, go back to 1980, Ronald Reagan is campaigning against Jimmy Carter and saying that the Carter administration has too fond of job-killing regulations, this expression of job-killing regulations, this idea that regulation is bad. And, you know, yes, regulatory capture, this sort of revolving door connecting these regulatory agencies and the industries that they're supposed to be putting a damper on or having a putting some controls on. But you also have this idea that regulations in general are just a net bad thing overall. And both, you know, both parties, when in power, sort of hew to this line. The Democrats much less so than the Republicans, to be sure. But, you know, this idea that's sort of generally accepted amongst the ruling elite that companies should be allowed to do what they want. And this is understandable. If you have a lot of money, you want to keep it. But when it comes to flying safety, the reason that we have such remarkably safe skies is because there are mountains and mountains of regulations. And every time something goes wrong, government inspectors go out and determine what happened and figure out how to fix it and then write rules to implement those changes. If your attitude is you want to remove two regulations for everyone you add, what you're doing is throwing away rules that have saved lives. And so this situation where Boeing has produced what seems to be rather recklessly designed plane for the sake of its, you know, primarily for business reasons, is a direct result of that, as I argue in my Slate and New York Times pieces.
Well, from what I understand, what they did with the 737, which is a very successful plane, obviously it's ubiquitous, they decided to add length to it, so put more seats in. They had to put more powerful engines in it. And because the engines were bigger, they had to move them further out on the wings. And that meant that the plane literally had to fly by computer. And that's why at the center of all this is the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, the MCAS, which is what everybody's looking at, because it essentially, in the case of those two airlines, the Lion Air and the Ethiopian Air, the situation appears to be that the machines took over from the humans and the humans couldn't stop the machines and the machines crashed the planes. Is that a sketch of what happened?
That's essentially right. You know, it's kind of a long and winding road of decision placed upon decision. Now, the story goes back to 1967 when this plane was first designed, and the plane was built at a time when there were a lot of smaller airports didn't have jetways, right? And so they wanted to have a plane where you could lower a door. You could open a door and lower a set of stairs, and your passengers could climb down the stairs and get onto the runway. This was in 1967. That made a lot of sense back then. In order to do that, the plane had to have short landing gear so that the stairs didn't have to be too long. Because the landing gear is short, 50 years later, that means it's hard to put a big engine under the wing. There's not enough room. And so you have to, like, sling it forward and move it further than you normally would. And as a result of that, when you have a more powerful engine that's located further forward on the plane, that produces a situation where under low speed and high power, for instance, on takeoff, you have a plane that's dynamically unstable, which means that when the plane starts to get nose high, it wants to go more nose high. And this is why you have to, and so this is what Boeing is stuck with. It's stuck trying to put big engines on a 52-year-old design. You wind up through this sort of chain of events, this chain of decision-making, with a plane that's unstable. How do you fix this? Well, their decision is to put on an automated system that kicks in, not all the time, but only under these particular situations where the plane is at risk of getting into an unstable and unrecoverable situation. And so that's where we are today, with a plane that probably shouldn't still be flying. You know, the idea that you're getting onto a 52-year-old plane every time you get on a 737 is kind of a crazy idea. Boeing had considered starting with a blank sheet of paper and starting new, and starting with new technology, new long landing gear, powerful engines, wings, everything from scratch, brand new. They decided not to do that because in order to do that, they would have to sell a new plane instead of selling the old plane that people already have in stock. And we know when you already have this sort of plane in inventory, it's much cheaper and more efficient. You don't have to buy new parts. The mechanics are familiar with working with it. The pilots don't have to be retrained. That's very appealing. And when you're in a fierce competition with Airbus, the managers, the businessmen, the executives at Boeing said, okay, that's what we're going to do. We're going to keep the old model. Maybe it'll be less flyable, but whatever. It's going to be very appealing from a business perspective, not from a safety perspective. So the question we think we have to ask is, should we just give up on this plane? Should this plane even be flying? Why don't we just build a new, better plane?
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Wise, a science journalist specializing in aviation and psychology, a licensed pilot. He has served as an on-camera aviation analyst on CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, and his articles have appeared in the New York Magazine, the New York Times, Time, Business Week, Esquire, and many others. And he's the author of The Taking of MH370 and has an article at Slate, When the Rules Disappear, How the American Fervor for Deregulation Contributed to the 737 MAX Crashes. Now, you mentioned for every one new regulation, you get rid of two. And that was the arbitrary formula that Donald Trump came up with. And in general, the impression is that across the board, throughout the cabinet, there's been regulatory capture. We're now learning about some of the activities of the new Secretary of the Interior that are being investigated. So, but my sense is that this is incredibly short-term thinking, you know, to free up the businesses to get rid of the shackles of regulation, and when it ends up backfiring. I mean, my understanding of Boeing is it's probably one of the most successful American companies globally, and it's now taking a huge black eye. So if we're going to turn into a banana republic with inside trading and family businesses taking over and all this kind of stuff that's going on with this administration, at the end of the day, isn't brand America going to suffer?
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think that this kind of short-term thinking, short-term profits above all else, is a kind of mental illness that seems to have taken over a certain portion of the ruling class. And, there was a time when, Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. He, wanted to have a system of national parks, there was a kind of progressive conservatism that, was in favor of birth control and things like this. The EPA was set up, if I recall correctly, under Richard Nixon. This idea that to be a true conservative, we have to burn all of our bridges and convert eat our seed corn constantly. I find highly irrational. I think if I was a billionaire, I would want to, or CEO of Boeing or GM or whatever, I would think that I would see it in my own best interest to create a world that was, functioning optimally for my grandchildren. I don't understand why the people who are in charge of society today seem to have no interest whatsoever in its condition 5 years from now. And yes, Boeing has spent. The first Boeing flew less than a decade after Orville Wright, and this is a company that's been burnishing its reputation for decades. They have everything to lose in terms of the premium that is attached to their name. They are the world's largest airplane manufacturer. That's a position that you gain and you keep by having the public trust you. And so why you would just treat that trust as if it was something of no consequence is frankly baffling to me.
Well, but in terms of the free market, there's also a phenomenon of kind of right-wing socialism, for the want of a better description. The idea that Boeing has been so subsidized. I mean, they received $100 billion in unclassified defense contracts between 2014 and 2018. And $64 billion in federal loans and loan guarantees, and $457 million in federal grants from 2000 to 2014. And they've got, 98 lobbyists on Capitol Hill, 71 of whom have previously worked for Congress, and some of them have been like Norm Dix, the Democrat from Washington, whose nickname is Mr. Boeing. And before then, of course, you had Senator Scoop Jackson, who was often referred to as the senator from Boeing. So how much is that the idea of subsidized capitalism? Is that an issue in this whole story?
Well, I mean, again, I think it gets back to the question of, it's nothing new that big business and the U.S. government get along well. Democrats and Republicans alike They love jobs. They love campaign contributions. And, you know, of course they're going to, they have, I mean, whether they should is another issue, but yes, they treat their large manufacturers very well. I do think that in the past, something is different today. I mean, everything you just told me, or said to the audience, I should say, everything you've just said has been true for a very long time. What is different today? Why are the powers that be behaving in such a way that they are shooting themselves in the foot in the interest of some ostensible short-term benefit? Why are they acting as though there are no consequences? This is, I think, the key. We now have leadership that has no concept of consequences. And if you have a leader whose entire life has been existing and exerting himself in the world, behaving criminally, behaving immorally, and time and time again, the message he seems to be sent is there are no consequences for your bad behavior. I think this leads to a very dangerous and, frankly, destructive attitude towards governance.
Well, that's been reinforced by this four-page summary sent by the Attorney General, William Barr. I mean, right. We haven't even seen the Mueller report, and everybody's exonerating Trump. And if that's the case, then talk about rewarding bad behavior.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, to see the response to the Barr memo, where you have outlets like the New York Times to treat Barr says that the Mueller memo says, the Mueller report says, as equivalent to the Mueller report says, is allowing a dangerous degree of goodwill, assuming goodwill on the part of Barr, which I think there's absolutely no reason to do.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, you were saying that the plane should be scrapped, and obviously already Airbus picked up orders from the Chinese who've cancelled the 737 MAX 8 orders. So, and there's MAX 9 as well. I don't know what the story with that is, but we pretty much established, you've explained why this plane is some Rube Goldberg type of disaster waiting to happen.
Yes.
What's your final thoughts on what we can expect to save the Boeing brand? And could they, I mean, it'd take a while to go back to scratch and make a new plane, wouldn't it?
It would. It would take a long time. And I think based on past behavior, Boeing will do everything in its power to resist that. But the power ultimately lies neither with Boeing nor with the government. It lies with the consumer. And if people will not fly this plane, if airlines will not have them in their fleet because the customers won't allow it, then the decision will be made for Boeing. And Boeing will have to come up with a clean sheet design, which they've been considering for years, by the way. I mean, it's something that they've just postponed, but it is inevitable. And the timing just may be decided for them.
But you're one of the few voices that are saying that this plane is unsafe. And when are the public going to learn that they shouldn't get on this plane?
I don't know if I'm the only person saying that. I mean, I've seen it dubbed the death machine. In German, the press has called it the Angstmodell, the fear model. I mean, there's clearly a great deal of anxiety about this airplane in the press.
Well, Jeff Wise, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Wise, who's a science journalist specializing in aviation and psychology, a licensed pilot. He has served as an on-camera aviation analyst on CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, and his articles have appeared in the New York Magazine, the New York Times, Time, Business Week, Esquire, and many others. And he's the author of The Taking of MH370, and he has an article at Slate, When the Rules Disappear, How the American Fervor for Deregulation Contributed to the 737 MAX Crashes. We can take a restation break. We'll be back with an update from a country that is disintegrating into chaos and lawlessness and is poised on the brink of civil war.
Porque está viejo y cansado. pesado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Virginia Lopez, a journalist who's covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. And she had a recent article at the New York Times, "Nothing Can Prepare You for Life with Hyperinflation." Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And we're having to tape this interview because the power keeps going out. At the moment, you have no power, but you're on a cell phone, so you've got a battery. And for some reason or other, the cell towers are working. So we'll make the most of it. What kind of coverage is they having down there now on the meeting today in the White House between the wife of Juan Guaido, the alternative leader of Venezuela, meeting with President Trump, along with the wife of Guaido's chief of staff, who was recently arrested by SEBIN, the intelligence service?
It's mostly word of mouth. I mean, the people that have access to Wi-Fi have read about it or have seen the images. Everybody was very surprised that Trump seems to have taken the time to meet with them. I think this meeting didn't include him originally. But again, you know, we have, in a sense, bigger problems to worry about. So, you know, it's, like I said, it's been mainly word of mouth.
Well, of course, the headline that came out of the meeting was not so much about Guaido's widow and the wife of the chief of staff who's been arrested, but mostly it was Trump saying that Russia has to get out of Venezuela. What do you know about what was shipped into Venezuela in those that big transport plane along with another aircraft?
Again, very little. I personally haven't had power for the last 2 days or so. But we know that they arrived on Saturday. And of course, it caused a huge stir. It was seen in a way as sort of a sign of weakness on the part of the U.S. after Elliot Abrams met in Rome with the Russian government. There was rumors that it could be technicians that were coming to help with the electricity situation, but you know, there's also big fears that it could be basically, you know, troops. I don't feel responsible telling you exactly, you know, that I know what it was or that I have the answer, because it's impossible to know.
Right. Well, there's been some reports that there were Spetsnaz, the Russian special forces, a sort of Praetorian guard to protect Maduro. But it seems like the opposition people need protection because the White House chief of staff, he was framed, was he not? Didn't the SEBIN, the intelligence goons, show up, planted a couple of rifles and a grenade and arrested him?
Yes, certainly. That was last week, and it was sort of like a midnight raid.
Right.
That isn't necessarily unfamiliar to us, but yes, it's still, you know, it still always surprises you, especially because the European Union had a team here that was trying to meet with both groups, to sort of begin, I would assume, some sort of talks or some sort of, you know, a solution to the ongoing crisis. So it certainly doesn't seem like the best way to treat your opposing leader's chief of staff if you want to try and find a solution that won't, you know, sink the country into further problems or into, you know, God forbid, a civil confrontation.
Well, clearly, though, it's also a signal, isn't it, to intimidate Guaido by Maduro? You know, he can't, I guess he doesn't feel bold enough to arrest Guaido himself, but he certainly, the next best thing, I guess, is arresting his chief of staff.
Certainly, absolutely. There was also, during the raid, they took his phone, and I think that they managed to, you know, I guess, find out a lot of what the conversations between Guaido and his chief of staff were, and so there was a a presser with Jorge Rodriguez, you know, somehow, you know, a part of it was, you know, denouncing what he was saying. It was, you know, corrupt dealings within the opposition, but also, in a way, also like petty gossip. So, you know, I think there was also an attempt to divide or weaken the opposition. Of course, I have to say that, you know, going through a second major blackout kind of diminishes for a second, at least, the political standoff.
Well, it's clearly a country that's falling apart, and we've had that conversation for the longest time. It's not as if it just is accelerating now, and it's extraordinary. My understanding is that even amongst the colectivos and the Bolivarian circles, as they call the diehard supporters of Chavez and his successor Maduro, aren't those neighborhoods now starting to turn against Maduro for the simple reason that they can't get food, electricity, and medicine?
We saw a large episode of riots and looting in the second largest city in Maracaibo, and then basically, you know, the images coming out of that city were almost seemed straight out of Mad Max. They basically cannibalized the whole city. They took everything from shoes to copper wiring. I mean, they really did destroy what had once been the capital of the oil industry here in Venezuela. So, yes, I think, you know, discontent is widespread. And certainly, you know, living with hyperinflation is one thing, but living without power is a whole different ballgame. You know, we're talking hospitals that couldn't assist dying patients, newborn babies that died because incubators were failing. You know, it just takes it to a whole different level. And of course, we're talking about an oil industry that is not going to be able to start when there's no power.
Well, of course, this was some along the lines of what Juan Guaido's wife said in the Oval Office today with President Trump, talking about children dying, etc. But when you say they looted, who was they? Who did the looting?
You know, there's a huge information blackout. There were reports that it had been angry citizens, but it was also said that that what started off as a protest became, you know, an episode of looting because armed colectivos somehow instigated the crowds or somehow started, you know, intimidating the crowds, and then it all became, you know, the sort of opportunistic destruction or ransacking of the city.
So is there any indications that whatever the strategy is on the part of the Trump administration, as far as we can tell, the idea was to, first of all, they tried to get alternative aid through and it didn't work. And there were reports that Maduro government burned the aid trucks, but then it turns out to be that, in fact, the protesters burned their trucks. And
I don't agree with that interpretation of the events. I think this was an episode of incredible tension with armed colectivos or armed militia attacking protesters that, for the most part, you know, had been somehow somewhat peaceful in trying to get this aid in. And, you know, in the midst of this sort of confusion or chaos or even fear, they started some sort of clashes, and, you know, perhaps accidentally a Molotov cocktail made it to the truck. But I don't think you can undermine what it is to be in the middle of this type of clash when colectivos appear. It's just a daunting type of situation, and, you know, it's,
right,
it's all hell breaks loose. These are men that are out to shoot and kill fearlessly because they know that they have the backing of the government. There were also pictures of a minister cheek to cheek with the colectivos in the middle of the clashes. So, you know, again, it's a very sort of a volatile, dangerous situation.
Well, obviously the colectivos are vigilantes, and they can kill people with impunity. And it would seem this is one of the problems of trying to report this, is that you've got a lot of leftists in the US and in Europe, etc., that still have this nostalgia for Chavez and seem to think that this is all a terrible American imperialism going back to the sort of Cold War days, and that nobody, of course, feels very comfortable about having your champions, Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, and John Bolton, or Marco Rubio for that matter. So that tends to, that's why the reporting that I was referring to was rebuttals coming from kind of, you know, the leftist nostalgic group that still pine for Chavez and seem to be in total denial about the reality of what's happening in your country.
Well, I think, you know, I think that this is a debate that differs greatly when you're inside Venezuela and when you're outside, not only because those of us who live here have to confront the hardships of decades of misrule on a daily basis, and we have seen loved ones killed or had to forcefully leave the country, but also because, you know, I think in the U.S. it tends to be perceived, probably thanks to Trump, as a sort of socialist versus capitalist debate, whereas in Venezuela it's largely seen as, you know, democracy versus authoritarianism. You know, but again, if there, anybody is confused about it, I invite them to come over. It's they should probably clarify their doubts very quickly.
So, is there a sense on your part that this agony is going to end? I mean, I started to mention that it seems that the Trump administration's strategy of cutting off the oil revenues, trying to find alternative aid, trying to encourage the military to turn against Maduro, none of those things seem to be dislodging Maduro. And now he's always had the Cubans backing him and, you know, basically keeping an eye on the military and stop any kind of coups. And now you've got the Russians showing up. They've obviously got a big stake in this in terms of investment. So the Chinese. Is there an end game here, or is this just agony, you know, piled upon agony?
I think that unless the military are given a attractive offer, very much like in Chile with Pinochet, they'll have no incentives to oust Maduro. That's on one hand. On the other hand, I think that you're also going to confront an even bigger exodus to neighboring countries in the region. So, you know, I think that it's probably going to be agony after agony for the region, as well as for those of us who are living here still, unless, you know, there is some sense anytime soon.
Well, in your piece in the New York Times recently, nothing can prepare you for life with hyperinflation. The impression was that at the end of the day, this situation is unsustainable and that one way or other, Maduro will go. Do you still feel that that's likely?
The events of the past week make me doubt. I mean, we all saw Mugabe cling to power forever despite hyperinflation. Again, you know, authoritarian leaders have a way of you know, tightening the grip on power. So it's hard to say. The sensical or the logical part of me wants to think that a leader who'd be interested in his people would try to make living conditions better for the vast majority. And if that means that they need to step aside so that sanctions are lifted or so the country has access to loans, he would do so. But, you know, I guess this isn't a logical decision by a virtuous leader. I don't know. I think, you know, tensions are escalating quickly. But, you know, on the other hand, I would hate to see any kind of social uprising like the one we saw in Maracaibo become a widespread event in the rest of the country. And like I was told by a shop owner in one of these poor sectors, rarely ever people tend to oust governments. It's generally the military, but people alone are not, you know, not able to bring about regime change. So, you know, I think sadly the future of Venezuela seems to depend more on outside forces now than the military within, or even the opposition, obviously.
Well, at this point, do you think the outside forces coming in from Russia, even though it's just a couple of plane loads, and China, of course, has got a lot of debts that they want to collect, and they've mortgaged the oil for China, and of course, the oil's not being pumped. There's no electricity to pump it. And so, and one of the things that I've been told is that you know, the country suffered such a brain drain that the best and brightest have gotten out of the country, and there's just no engineers and technicians to keep things running, and that may explain the blackouts. Is that the case?
That's the case up to a certain extent, but you know, I think that what you have here is just a crisis piling on top of another crisis. So it's not only brain drain, but it's, you know, it's mismanagement, it's lack of investment, it's paying workers, you know, atrocious wages. It's, you know, it's, I think the military term for it is a cluster, but I'm not sure that I can say that on air.
Right.
But yes, so, you know, I think, I mean, we've gotten to the point where it's difficult to see where it begins and where it ends. But certainly, you know, the fact that all of the engineers that knew where to turn the electricity on have left is just an additional inconvenience, no? Again, there's a lot of political will that would make things easier and that it's just simply lacking.
Well, just in closing, Virginia Lopez, why are you staying? It's dangerous. You've had neighbors murdered in their beds. The colectivos roam the streets and could shoot you and your children at random. I don't mean to get too personal, but if you had a way out, would you leave?
I have a way out. You know, I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm a European citizen. Up to this point, I thought that a solution was possible, not, you know, to the political standoff. I thought that, you know, people would think of the common good, or that, you know, if worse came to worse, you know, that there would be some sense to this whole thing. We call it denial, I guess. But again, you know, like after losing power and seeing the whole country be plunged into darkness, I'm sort of losing faith. I don't think that this is going to end anytime soon. I think that, you know, I see the politicians or the leaders here becoming more and more entrenched in their positions. And I see an opposition that is united, surprisingly, but still unable to bring about any change. And the military, unfortunately, have decided to protect their interests. So, you know, I don't know how long I can stand this. You know, like you said, I've got children and I've lost faith, I guess. I guess that's the short version of that to that question.
Well, I thank you for joining us, and I wish you the best, even though that sounds pretty pathetic under the circumstances.
Thanks for having me, and hopefully I'll be wrong.
And again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's in Caracas, Venezuela. She's a journalist who covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian in Al Jazeera English, and she had a recent article at the New York Times, "Nothing Can Prepare You for Life with Hyperinflation." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by an activist and performance artist who stages acts of creative resistance. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Jordina Salabert, better known by her stage name Jill Love, an artist and activist whose work features public performance art and demonstration to create public awareness of human rights, the environment, animal rights, and LGBT rights. She is known internationally for her work involving performance art and artistic passive resistance in public spaces using the human body. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jill Love.
Thank you so much, Ian, for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, what I understand you do is creative resistance. Is that a way to describe what you do?
Well, it's the art of protest, which is going to be the title of my second book, The Art of Protest. So there is a different way of protest, which doesn't involve violence, breaking things and screams and chaos and, you know, which doesn't do much in my opinion. So this is more like using your creative skills, your art, your inner voice to protest the injustices that we all witness every day. And sometimes we feel so small, right? Like, oh, I cannot do anything about it, or I cannot change the world, or, you know, this, we make up all these excuses. But, you know, I just have this urge to do something about it. So, you know, I use my creativity, my talents to say, no, I don't agree with this. You know, I want change. I want people to take action. I want to inspire people to stand up, wake up, and go to the streets and say, hey, enough.
But you attract them to come to the streets by your performances, right? I mean, for example, Donald Trump's star on Hollywood Boulevard, which has been visited a number of times and smashed up a couple of times. They keep replacing it. You sat on a golden toilet right next to his
On top of it.
And tell me, how did the public respond, and what are the visuals? Because we're on radio, you know. So, and everything that you do is so visual. And you yourself are strikingly attractive. So
thank you. I appreciate it. So you know, like, I get these ideas by just walking on the street or going to the beach or hiking or being in a hot springs. I get these amazing ideas that, you know, and just like I always explain it that I'm an open vessel for the universe to manifest itself through me. So I get these ideas, and then, you know, I was walking in the boulevard, and I happened to walk, you know, over this infamous star on the Golden, on the Wall of Fame. Walk of Fame. Just mixing up words. And then I thought, oh my God, like, I'm really upset about what's going on, right? Because, you know, I mean, it's so surreal. I mean, this president is like, you know, like we haven't seen something like that before, not even with Nixon or Bush. It's like, you know, so
it's a nightmare, right?
It's a nightmare. But, you know, I cannot call names and be upset and feel miserable and stuff like that. So I have to just do something in my own way.
Well, but so you're sitting on the golden toilet on Donald Trump's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
I just want to explain what happened before because it's really interesting to explain the process. I was walking on the star, and then I had this idea of, what about if I'm bringing a toilet, a gold toilet, and just sit there and reading the Time magazine, Men of the Year, and see what happens, how people react. So the day after, I found a toilet on the sidewalk right there waiting for me.
Really?
And it was all nice and clean, ready to be painted, spray gold, you know. So, and then I had some friends like say, oh, you know, I have a Time magazine from when Trump was featured, right? With Men of the Year. Remember
magazine? There's some dispute that he may have made that up himself. Has he ever been on the is a real Time?
Yeah.
I thought he'd always aspired to be on the cover and never was, and made up a cover. But anyway.
But that cover is really interesting because in the M of Time, it's on top of his head, like two horns.
Oh, really?
You know, so Time is really like with these subliminal messages that only smart people can pick on it, you know, pick up on it. So just everything came together, and then I had a beautiful dress, golden dress, and I thought, okay, I'm just going to go and, you know, just create this golden rabbit hole on Trump's star.
Right.
Because he always like talks about the whole countries, right? So, you know, walk around Hollywood and you will see it's no different than anywhere else. Right. Any other whole country.
Of Lagos, know? Nigeria, right.
Yeah, so so you know, I always have a group of friends that they're always helping me, you know, and just somebody with a camera filming, or somebody just to carry the heavy stuff, you know, somebody just to cover my back, have my back. So I went there, I did my thing, you know, and I was totally focused doing my own business, you know, with a really beautiful dress, and I had my panties, pink panties on my ankles. And I was just reading the magazine, you know, and then all this congregation of people around me, right?
Sure.
Taking photos and saying things, you know, some pro-Trump supporters, some other people like saying, wow, you go, girl. So, you know.
Right. Welcome to divided America, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, in my performance, they're all united somehow, you know? So they all come together and they never fight with each other. They just like, they just witness my
creations.
But
that's the beauty of creative resistance. It's the friendliness of art, the amusement. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there's a big balloon of a baby Trump that follows Trump around the world. It makes him crazy, but it's in the spirit of what you do.
Yeah, what can you do about it? What can you say about it? Harmless, funny, childish. So, you know, it's not like somebody yelling at you and grabbing you, hey, look at this, and you know. You know, it's something that you choose to stop and witness and enjoy, or you can just keep going and walking. And so nobody's forcing you to look at it.
Right. So speaking of the human body, tell us about what you did in Spain to protest oil spills on beaches. Mm-hmm. I take it you showed up naked, covered in oil. Is that...
Yeah. So I went back to Spain. You know, I've been here since 2006, but I had to go back at some point, right? So just to visit family, friends. So that time it was 2013, and there was this huge thing about this foreign oil drilling company wanted to drill oil off the coast of Ibiza and Canarias Islands, you know, which are like preserved and protected marine preserves. So because the government, the Spanish government, is so corrupted, so you know, they're like, they take the money and they don't really care about anything else, right? So the government was sold to allow this foreign company to drill off the coast of these amazing islands, which bring lots of tourism and boosting the economy and everything. So imagine an oil spill on those islands, right? It's like crazy. So I was imagining the effects of allowing this to happen in the future. I always explain that I came from the future. So I see the future. So I came back from the future to warn everyone of the possibility of this dark dark future, you know. So I thought, growing up, I watched these animals, these seals, these whales, these dolphins covered with oil, washed off the shore on the beach, you know. I grew up watching those images. Because Spain is like 3/4 is surrounded by water, and we have lots of activity going on, and we had spills. So I thought, I'm just going to go to the main cities, Madrid, Barcelona, you know, and just go covered with oil, which is a special mix of weed and oil and food colorant, completely naked, which, you know, that's what people are attracted to, right? So you have to use what you have. So, you know, have a nice body and I'm tall, so I better use what God gave me. And then I just had some fish, dead fish, and I was laying on the sidewalks, on the streets, you know, on the of the main avenues in Madrid. La Gran Vía, you know La Gran Vía?
Yeah.
Like the Hollywood Boulevard here. So, and then all the media, all the press came, they covered the event.
But did you stimulate some kind of debate or what kind of press coverage? Was the press coverage just sensational or was it thoughtful?
Thoughtful, really thoughtful, because people are really aware of this tragedy that you know, oil drilling, oil companies, and it's just all bad news. You know, oil is death, and it's just part of the old world, which has no.
Well, it's killing this world.
Yeah, exactly. So can we just move on and just, you know, use the sun and the wind and the ocean and natural resources, like, you know.
So did it impact the oil drilling contracts in Ibiza and the Canaries? In other words, did the Spanish government sell these leases and are the oil companies there? Is it happening?
Well, so little by little, my movement kept growing. So more people were joining. And then the biggest event was in Ibiza on the beach. We were like 30 protesters laying on the beach covered with oil, like dead dolphins and whales. And we had like hundreds of people around us wearing black. Like it was like a funeral with signs saying, no, we don't want this. So those images, they went viral all over the world. So it created this thing that everybody was talking about it. You know, people were like revolting on the streets by thousands. So everybody was really active, you know. Like in Spain, we have this history of revolution. We're really revolutionaries, you know. We don't take like we used to back in the days. We learned from that. So we ended up stopping the foreign oil drilling companies. We stopped them and we sent them where they came from. So it never happened. So that's the power of the people, not just me. I'm not taking credit for it. You know, it's the power of the people when we unite and we get together with one goal. It's amazing. So
what would you say to our audience as we wrap up this interview in terms of you're saying, you know, get off the couch, take to the streets. And this is a very artistic community. And I'm sure you've been here a while in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
Talented people have been coming to this place for over 100 years to make films, to make music, to write, to dance, to do television. It's an extraordinary creative community. And one of the purposes of this alternative radio station in terms of its original mission was to use these facilities for the community to express themselves. So is there a message that you can give to all the listeners out there in this incredibly creative community that maybe they've got to start discovering themselves and what they can say and what they can do?
Yeah, I agree. This is I think it's the capital of the world. We have the most talented, creative people from all over, from all corners of the world here. So, but we all have like personal agendas, right? We all want to be
Everybody famous. Wants to be a movie star, right?
Yeah, we want to be rich and famous and this and that. But meanwhile, we can still get together and just unify forces and talents to really preserve this planet, which is, we're running out of time. I mean, we're running out of time. And we all know it, and we don't do anything about it. And, you know, and in the deathbed, once the day before, the night before we die, we're going to regret all the things we didn't do while we could. Right? And it's going to be too late, guys, you know, so start doing something now, you know?
Right. Well, it's even more urgent because there is a focus here. I did a recent interview with a guy that wrote a book about the uninhabitable Earth, and he pointed out
that 30 years ago, Bill McKibben warned about global warming, and so did Al Gore. So 30 years have passed when we've known about global warming and nothing really has been done. And we know that Donald Trump and his regime are turning back the clock. They're not just denying global warming, they're actively reversing what little steps have been made to deal with it. So I would suggest that a lot of our listeners could have a simple focus is, it's bad as it is having Donald Trump turn back the clock. If he gets another 4 years, in other words, he gets 2 terms, 8 years, if he gets reelected, the planet could pass the point of no return. So it seems to me that beyond politics, this is an imperative that, you know, we're all on lifeboat Earth together. And the Donald Trump is drilling a hole in the lifeboat, and we may be bailing out the water, but we're sinking. And I think we are running out of time. I mean,
you're the artist.
Tell me what your message would be to motivate people.
We are the ones to blame for it, because we don't do enough. We don't say enough. We don't complain enough. We don't take action enough. Trump is our dark shadow. You know, it's reflecting our shadows and weaknesses. So in a way, he's really making America great again, because many of us are realizing that, you know, we have to do something about it. We're waking up and we're revolting. We're taking the streets, you know, Women's March. And now we have more female presence in Congress, Senate. You know, women are really like fed up and taking action, but that's not enough. Like all these people who don't vote, who just don't give a shit, they're apathetic. They don't bother to even like, you know, just share a link, just talk to your neighbors and your family about the dangers. Just, you know, bring what's really important right now in your society on the table, you know, because we're running out of time and this is our chance. So like you said, we cannot allow this man to be another 4 years, because, you know, myself, I just turned 39 and I'm debating, should I bring a child to this world? Like everybody's asking me, are you a mom yet? And I say, why? Why you want me to bring an innocent soul into this f***ed up world? So I don't really want to be a mom. I just don't feel it's a safe place to be, right? I'd rather adopt and save a child than just bring another one here. So let's do something all together, you know. Let's find what unify us instead of what divide us, you know. I'm from Spain, you're from here, you're a man, I'm a
actually
woman.
Actually from Australia.
There you go. So
further away.
But, you know, we have to realize we're all one.
Right.
Just different perceptions of reality, but we're all one consciousness. So now it's time to do something about it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Georgina Salabert, who's better known by a stage name, Jill Love. She's an artist and activist whose work features public performances, performance art, and demonstrations to create public awareness of human rights, the environment, animal rights, and LGBT rights. And she's known internationally for her work involving performance art and artistic passive resistance in public spaces using the human body. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.